Luke chapter 8 is our text this morning. Luke chapter 8. My daughter, Abby, just started in on her third job this week of the summer. That doesn't mean she lost the other two. She still has the other two, but she added a third one. She's going to be a barista at Big B, right? She's added that to the mix. No pun intended, I guess, there. But she had to go through some pretty intensive training, right? They bring you in and they set you down with this person and you go through a shift and just they're showing you what to do and all the different ingredients and all the ways that you prepare the various drinks that they offer. And it's a pretty rigorous process, you know, before you can really even sort of start working on your own. And so when you think about that, that's pretty characteristic of probably most new assignments. Certainly, if you're in a workplace, there's probably some protocol for training for you, even if it's a simple thing like learning to take out the trash, right? Mom or dad might sit you down and talk through what's involved in that and what to do with different contingencies and what if the bag leaks and where does it have to be placed at the road, right? There's some type of protocol or training that's attached to even the simplest of tasks. And I'm going to suggest to you that that's what's happening here in Luke chapter 8. Jesus has been ministering with the crowds, and now he's going to step away with his disciples. And at least part of what is going to be happening there is training. Now, he doesn't come out and say it. He doesn't say to the disciples, you know, we're going to step aside now. I have five lessons I want to teach you. He just takes them aside. They go on a little bit of a retreat, a little journey, and along the way, he is teaching them. He's preparing them, right? We know what's coming. They are going to be, after Jesus dies and is buried and raised and ascends to the Father, they are going to be commissioned to go out on their own. And so he's taking them with him. He's modeling for them at this stage. He's modeling for them how to do ministry and what it involves and making sure they're clear on the message of the kingdom, right? He's going about proclaiming it from town to town. But eventually, he's going to send them out on their own, two by two. So what we're seeing here is a training session. And that's good for us, isn't it? Because we need training. We've been given that same commission. It's now come to us. We've received the baton. And so there's some really great stuff here for us to think about our own calling as followers of Christ, as ones who are called to be messengers of the gospel. Just for context's sake, Jesus again had embarked on this speaking tour with his 12 disciples and with a significant group of women, a large group of women. We're told this in the opening verses of Luke chapter 8. And specifically, he was proclaiming from town to town the good news of the kingdom of God. I don't know what your perceptions are of Christianity. Maybe you're here as a newcomer today. If you are, we're so glad that you're here today. Let's just be clear that the message that Jesus came to bring is good news. It is the best of all possible news. If you don't think it's the best news of all, then you haven't understood it. It is the promise of a new kingdom, a new regime, of an enduring kingdom of perfect peace and justice. There's a solution to all of the things that ail us, both physically and emotionally and relationally and spiritually in this world. There is a new day coming, and Jesus has come proclaiming it and inviting people to participate in this great coming kingdom. Who wouldn't want to be a part of it, right? And as we see here, the crowds begin to gather. This is good news, certainly, for these first century Jewish people, because their land had been taken over by the Romans. They were now living under subjection to a foreign entity. And so when Jesus comes talking about a coming kingdom, a kingdom of peace and righteousness, God's kingdom, they are all in, right? So they're all gathering. The crowd is thick and the masses are coming. But there's a problem here under the surface. It might seem like a good thing. Jesus' message is beginning to pick up momentum, but Jesus is concerned that many of these people, while they aspire to be in this kingdom, while they really like the sounds of it, are really not friends of the kingdom. They want the benefits of this kingdom, but they are not willing to come under the authority of the king. And so Jesus says essentially in the earlier section here in chapter 8, verses 4 through 21, he says this is a package deal. The true citizens of God's kingdom are the ones who hear and obey God's word. That's the driving point. He says it multiple times in multiple ways in that section. Those who are truly part of my family, part of God's family, are the ones who hear his word and do it. Right? He drives that point home to them. The curious crowd that had gathered, many of them were uncommitted, and Jesus puts out a hard statement. I know you all want to be part of the kingdom, and maybe you assume you're going to be part of the kingdom, but let me just tell you that not everyone is going to be a part of the kingdom. It's not popular in our politically correct culture to say that. There is a heaven and there is a hell. I don't say it with joy. I don't say it with pride or the sense of arrogance. I just say it because God's word says it. And Jesus didn't pull any punches with this crowd. He didn't want anyone to think that they were fine and to think that they were at peace with God when they weren't. And so he challenges them and challenges the crowd, calling them to truly submit to the king. So there's this time of teaching with the crowd and an intensive time of ministry, and then Jesus pulls the disciples away. And that's the section we're going to look at here today. He gets into a boat, he gives instructions for the disciples, his inner group of committed followers to go out in the boat. We're going to take a journey to the other side of the lake. I think there were a couple of reasons for this. One is just that Jesus needed to rest. They needed to rest. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. But the fact that when Jesus gets in the boat, he falls asleep immediately into the soundest sleep you've ever seen tells us something about a level of emotional depletion, all right? So there's a sense of just rest and retreat that's part of this. And secondly, as I've already suggested, there's a training element here that Jesus is pulling away with his committed followers because he has something he wants to teach them. And it's not overt here in the text. There's no place that says that. I'm just suggesting to you that that's what the text bears out, all right? So let's look together, with that in mind, let's look together at Luke chapter 8, beginning in verse 22. Hear the word of the Lord. One day he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased. And there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid. And they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these, so he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then the people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. May God add his blessing to the reading of his word. As you noticed, this text has two distinct narratives. There's the storm on the sea, and there is the encounter with the demon-possessed man on the land. And I'm suggesting to you that we ought to consider these two accounts together as a unit. I suggest that for several reasons. First, they both happen on the same day, right? It's all part of what was happening there on that particular day. Also, these two accounts are mentioned in two of the other Gospels. And in every case, they're linked. They're connected together. We also see here that the trip to the other side is in view before they ever got in the boat. Right from the very outset, Jesus says, "Let's go to the other side." That was always in view and ought to be kept in view even as we consider what was happening out at sea. And there were also some consistent themes here that lead us to think that Jesus is teaching and reinforcing the same lesson with his disciples. So we're going to look through these two accounts in turn. There's a lot of material here I want to just kind of draw attention to, but then as we come to the end, I want to bring the two back together again and think big picture and try to understand the significance, the single lesson that Jesus was teaching to his disciples. So let's start with the storm at sea. I had to smile as I read just even the opening portion of this text when it says that one day Jesus got into a boat with his disciples. No reference to whose boat it was, no reference to whether he asked permission. He just got into the boat. And I think this is just so like Jesus, isn't it? Think about Jesus approaching the city of Jerusalem on that last week leading up to the crucifixion, and he sends two of the disciples ahead to the next village and says, "You'll find a donkey and a young colt tied there. I want you to take them and bring them to me. And if anyone asks you what you're doing, you know, Jedi mind trick. The master has need of them," right? And then later in the week, Passover is approaching. The disciples are elbowing one another. You know, "We don't have any plans for the Passover. You ask Jesus about it." Finally, Jesus says, "Go into the next town. You'll find a certain man. Tell him, essentially, that we'll be having Passover at your house today." Oh, okay. We'll get things ready, right? Sounds maybe perhaps to our ears a bit presumptuous, but this is Jesus. This is the one who has all authority. It's his world. And somehow from Jesus, it's very natural, isn't it, that he would give these kinds of instructions. Jesus got into the boat and indicated to the disciples they were going to go to the other side of the lake. Jesus had experienced an intense season of ministry. It's certainly been very physically taxing as they traveled from town to town on foot, sleeping on makeshift beds, but also very taxing emotionally and spiritually, right? He had extended himself to speak to thousands in the open air. You know, there's a physical exertion to that, but being hounded constantly every waking moment by people with various and sundry needs. And so Jesus finally has a chance to sit down in the boat, the cool breeze hitting him in the face, and it doesn't surprise us that he soon falls into the soundest of sleep there in the stern of the boat. And I simply draw attention to this here at the outset. We won't dwell long, but we should make it a priority to rest. But we need to say this as we think about who Jesus is. He is fully human, right? We see his humanity here, and that's important. Jesus was not just some sort of a divine being that sort of took on a certain form. No, he actually took on human flesh. He entered into humanity. He is a man. He is a human being. And as a human being, he experienced depletion and limitation and even exhaustion. He retreated. He took days off. He observed the Sabbath. And we ought to adopt these practices as well. If Jesus, who was not only man, but also the very Son of God, experienced the need to rest and step away from the demands of ministry and the opportunities of ministry, we certainly should take note. We should take our work very seriously, but we should also take our rest very seriously. We ought to prioritize and carve out white space on the calendar. It isn't always easy, is it? But it's important. And God has given us some regular, even weekly patterns to help us acknowledge our mortality, to humble ourselves before our Creator, and to rest. Well, Jesus falls asleep, and a storm comes up. The Sea of Galilee was not a large sea. As a matter of fact, we would probably more refer to it as a lake, especially in our neck of the woods here, right? In our part of the country. This is nothing like any of the Great Lakes, right? We could point to interior lakes in our own state that are more the size of the Sea of Galilee. So not very large. We know that this is the area of what's referred to as Galilee or Capernaum. Nazareth is up in this area up here. This is where he had been ministering, and he was going to set off across the lake. At the very widest portion, it would have been about an 8-mile stretch. But due to certain geological features, the Sea of Galilee was known for its sudden and violent storms. It is the lowest freshwater lake on the planet, more than 700 feet below sea level. And it is surrounded by mountains. It's like a bowl. I think we have a picture of this as well. I love this particular view from the west side of the Sea of Galilee, looking across over to the east side. And those mountains in the background are the Golan Heights. You'll sometimes read about this in even current news events, but you see those cliffs, all right? Think about the pigs. Think about the pigs going down the steep embankments, right, there. But the very nature of this, and I remember being on the Sea of Galilee with our guide, and he pointed to the western shore, and there was just a little cut in the mountains there, a little valley, and he said he had a name for it, but he said that's where oftentimes if the wind hits just right, it comes whistling through that valley into this bowl and stirs the water. So just some unique dynamics that would have brought about a very serious storm. They were taking on water, bailing, but unable to keep up. And even these seasoned fishermen, right? This is not their first rodeo. They've been on this lake before. They've fished it countless times. But even these seasoned fishermen recognized the seriousness of the situation, and they were convinced that the boat was going down and they were going to drown. And it was at this point that they wake Jesus. After all, how could he be sleeping at a time like this? I can't help but read my own perspective into this. I would be leaning out over the side, throwing up at the very first ripple on the water. You know my story with motion sickness, right? So I'm thinking, how can he sleep? But this obviously reflects his exhaustion, and I think it reflects his peace, right? his confidence in the situation. He was not unnerved by all of this. He does respond to their pleas. He speaks with authority to the wind and the waves, and the sea grows calm immediately. The storm stops. And then there's this pregnant pause. And he turns to them and says, "Where is your faith?" Mark's gospel, I think I included this in your notes there, Mark's gospel brings this across with some additional nuance. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? And to me, Jesus' comments here contribute to the lesson that the disciples were supposed to be learning. That is that we should not give way to fear. We should not give way to fear. Be natural to be concerned, but their response was an overreaction. We are dying. We are perishing, right? We are going to drown. Jesus had already told them that they were going to the other side. They were going to the other side. But they're overcome here with fear. When our son Johnny was growing up, he used to forget things like all the time. And he still does this on occasion, but it was really acute. And the most common thing, because of the Down syndrome, you know, he has to have his drinks thickened. It has to do with swallowing and his tendency to aspirate that fluid. And so his water bottle becomes a pretty big focus for us all the time. And so when he would leave it at school or he would leave it at church or whatever it might be, we would, in this exasperated, "Johnny, where's your water bottle?" And in the way that only Johnny could, he would say, "Don't panic, don't panic." And we would take a breath, and life would move on, right? I think the disciples were panicking, right? There's that great text in 1 Thessalonians that says that we should not grieve as those who have no hope. We grieve just like everyone else when we experience death or sickness and struggle, but we do not grieve as those who have no hope. And I think in a sense, this is part of the lesson here. We are concerned when we face difficulties and crises, but we should not panic as those who have no help. Right? The ways that we respond ought to be different than the ways people would respond if they have no relationship with God, no relationship with Jesus. And so we should not give way to fear. This is part of what Jesus is challenging them with when he says, again, why are you so afraid? Why are you so paralyzed with fear? Why is it that all you can see is disaster? Don't you have any confidence? Isn't there anything underlying here, your hope? Another lesson that flows out of this very challenge is that our faith should grow in response to God's faithfulness. Our faith should grow in response to God's faithfulness. The disciples should have known better. That's why he says there, "Do you still have no faith? After all that we have been through, after all that you have seen, you still don't believe?" Their faith should have grown in response to Jesus' past miracles. I think Paul develops this principle for us in his letter to the Philippians, chapter 4, where he says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." Right? So, when I'm prone to fear, when I'm anxious, I bring it to God, right? I make that request known, be known to God, and I do it with thanksgiving. I do it with an acknowledgement. "God, I bring this to you. I'm struggling. I don't know what to do. I'm afraid. But I know that you have provided for me faithfully in this episode and in this particular season of my life and in this particular tragedy, and you have been faithful to me. And so I come to you bringing my request, knowing that you are going to care for this need, right? That our track record with God and his proven faithfulness should grow my faith. And this seems to be part of what Jesus is confronting here, that they had not progressed. They hadn't added all of these other things to their arsenal of faith. Now, I find myself thinking or wondering what the disciples should have done. What would have been the optimum response? Jesus, again, is critical of their faith. He's critiquing something here, but what would it have looked like if they did it right? And I'll just acknowledge we're stepping out on a bit of speculation here, all right? But in my understanding, I think that they were right to take action and bail water and get to work, right? Faith doesn't mean that we just stand by passively. I think they started doing what they could, right, to respond to the storm. That is consistent with faith. I believe it was appropriate for them to bring their concern to Jesus. We had this conversation at the dinner table last night. Should the disciples have woken Jesus up out of his sleep? He needed the sleep so badly. Should they have woken him? And the crowd was divided at my house. But I don't think it's a bad thing that they woke Jesus up. I think they should have brought their concerns to him. But I think the conversation should have gone a little bit differently. Instead of saying, "Jesus, we're dying," I think they could have responded with faith. "Jesus, we're struggling a bit out here. I don't know if you've noticed the water level rising here. If you don't act, I'm just going to be honest with you, we're really in trouble here, right? But we saw what happened with the man with leprosy, and we saw what you did with the guy that was paralyzed." I mean, that was amazing. The guy through the roof and the whole deal. And we saw you raise the widow's son there in the village of Nain. And, you know, we could really use some of that stuff right now. You know, I mean, I'm putting myself out here. You know, we need you. There could have been, it probably wouldn't have been quite that expanded of an argument given the circumstances, right? But that there could have been some response of faith on their part when they brought their request to Jesus. Obviously, one of the main takeaways here is that Jesus has authority over the natural world. Jesus has authority over the natural world. And actually, this is where they first became afraid. Not during the storm, but overtly, they first became afraid after the storm was over, because they realized that Jesus was no mere mortal. He was human, but he was not just human. And they began to see the activity of God in these circumstances. But I don't know what storms, what particular obstacles, impossible situations that are on your horizon right now, but we ought to be encouraged to know that Jesus stands over those things. They don't control us. Jesus isn't wringing his hands. "I don't know what to do. I don't know how to solve this." In his sovereignty, he stands over those things in our lives. And that ought to bring us great encouragement. So the storm on the sea, and then what I'm calling the storm in the soul, and we need to move quickly here this morning. They proceeded on from that point in the middle of the lake to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee. The brief excursion had not gone as planned so far, but finally they were going to enjoy a pleasant picnic there on the shore. And of course, it didn't quite turn out that way, did it? As they step on shore, they're met by a naked, homeless, deranged, demon-possessed man. That will kill a picnic in a hurry, let me just assure you, right? This was pagan country. So here's another map here, now with the Sea of Galilee a little bit smaller on the map, so you can see the surroundings. And here's Galilee. This is the area where he was ministering. He goes across the Sea of Galilee to the opposite side. And here's the designation Decapolis, 10 Roman cities that existed, 9 of which were on that side, the east side of the Sea of Galilee. It was a Gentile area, and we don't really need a history lesson to know this because the text tells us, doesn't it? There were pigs. There was a herd of pigs. No self-respecting Jewish community would have had pigs grazing in its fields. This is a cross-cultural experience here now, as they land on this shore. This man was a Gentile, a bacon-eating Gentile. And to make matters worse, he was living among the tombs, among the dead. That too would have made a person unclean in a Jewish way of understanding. But Jesus has great compassion on this man. See the man's response when he recognizes it's Jesus. He cries out in terror, "Ah!" This is the response of the disciples when Jesus comes walking on the water and they think he's a ghost, right? They're scared. It's just a guttural reaction. This guy is terrified. It's that feeling you have when you wake up from your worst nightmare, right? Cold sweat. This is his response, right? It says he fell down. Could be a little misleading in our English translations. He didn't stumble. He fell at Jesus' feet. He bowed with his face to the ground, and he began begging for his life. These demons recognize that Jesus has complete authority over them. They are at his mercy. And I love how Luke gives us the narrative here. He says that this man had been a menace to the community. They could not contain him. They had to put guards over him. They tied him with chains and shackles, but he kept breaking loose. The demon gave him supernatural power. But here this man is completely, he's relinquished to groveling at Jesus' feet, right? I mean, Jesus has complete authority and control over these demons. And the demons identify him as the Son of the Most High God. There's a robust theology for you, right? Particularly in light of the disciples who are thinking, wow, this guy is more than a rabbi. Whoa. And here this man, this Gentile man, or the demons, is putting forward a much better Christology, a much better understanding of who Jesus actually is as the Son of God. Jesus asked the demon his name, and he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. Legion would have been up to 5,000 soldiers. This guy is under, he's in a bad spot. He is one messed up dude, right? And there's this herd of pigs. The demons ask permission to go into the pigs. The demons drive the herd down into the Sea of Galilee. Great scene of devastation. Mark's gospel tells us there were 2,000 pigs, around 2,000 pigs. And here's the takeaway: Jesus loves broken people. Just pause for a moment and consider what is happening here. This was Jesus' first and only trip into a Gentile region. His ministry would be predominantly with the Jewish people, but he shows such tremendous love and compassion. He places more value on one deranged, naked, crazy man than 2,000 pigs. And the takeaway is that Jesus loves us. I want to think about ourselves as it relates to the disciples and this training lesson that's going on, but the reality is I first have to see myself in this deranged, demon-possessed man, Gentile man, right? This is where we show up in the text, my friends. Most of us are not Jewish. We're Gentiles. And God has chosen to bring the message of the gospel, the message of the kingdom, to us. Jesus loves us. And that means he also loves your messed up coworker and the classmate with anger issues, right? And we are called to adopt that kind of love. This man also shows us a great deal about what a genuine convert looks like. Appropriate response to Jesus' radical grace and salvation is to obey him and to share what God has done. And this man, we finally find the townspeople coming back. They find the man clothed, sitting at Jesus' feet. This is the posture of a disciple. He is learning now. He is submitting to Jesus and learning to walk in his ways. And then he wants to go with Jesus, right? He wants to be a missionary. And Jesus says, no. When have you ever heard that, right? Jesus says, no, I want you to go back to your hometown. I want you to resume your job. And I want you to tell everybody there what God has done for you. And this man does it. The text is explicit. Not only did Jesus tell him to do it, he did it. He obeyed. He responded to God's great grace. Boy, we get a great picture here of what it looks like for a person to come to Christ and all the markings of a genuine response to the gospel. How does your life stack up to this man's life? Have you responded to God's grace in a similar way? All right, I'm going to move to just a conclusion here. I'm just going to leave a blank on your page just for fun. Because some of you, that really bothers you. I'll like blaze by it like really quickly, and then you can get it out of your system. No, I told you I wanted to land here, and it's a lot of lessons here to think about. Certainly this man's conversion, I think it foreshadows our own conversion experience, what that should look like as we encounter Christ. But then there's this thing going on again with the disciples and the training exercise in both of these accounts. And I want to just help connect the dots here. One of the threads that connects these two narratives together is the thread of fear. You see it there? The disciples encountered a storm at sea, and they were afraid, not during the storm so much as after the storm. They began to realize who Jesus was, right? The disciples were afraid when they realized that Jesus had power to calm deeply troubled seas. And then we see a similar scene unfolded with these townspeople, these Gentile townspeople, there on the other shore of the sea. Jesus casts the demons out of this man, and then the people of the town come out. The drama's over, the crisis is over, but we are told that they are afraid, right? They're afraid. Why are they afraid? The townspeople were afraid when they realized that Jesus had power to calm deeply troubled souls. They hadn't been able to do anything for this guy. And Jesus was able to touch him at a level they couldn't comprehend, right? This is only something God could do. So the disciples were enamored with Jesus' ability to calm the sea. But I think what's happening here is Jesus says, look, I've got bigger stuff I want to show you than that. It's great that you come to realize and have confidence that I can calm the sea and I have control over the natural world, but I want you to understand here, I want your faith to grow to the point to understand that I have control over the hearts of men and women. I'm able to bring healing at the deepest level that no doctor can touch. I'm able to change the heart. Really, this was the greater demonstration of Jesus' power, right? Not what happened on the sea, but what happened on the shore. These disciples needed to know that Jesus had authority over the wind and the waves, but even more than that, they needed to know that Jesus had authority over the human heart. They needed to know that he could save and transform most hopeless cases as they set out to take the gospel to the various peoples of the world. They needed to have a glimpse of God's great power and the power of his word and the power of his spirit. This lesson had been on the table before, right? Jesus showed them that he could bring fish into their net. But then he said, I can also bring people into your net, right? I'm not interested in just catching fish. That's just to show you my power, but I'm interested in catching people. I'm going to make you fishers of men. And I think a similar narrative is being taught here. Building their faith so that they would be able to go out with confidence and take the gospel to the world. And my friends, that task has now fallen to us. We've received that great commission. We've received the baton. And it can seem overwhelming at times, confronting people who maybe don't express an openness to the gospel. But we serve a God who can open hearts, a God who can do what we cannot do. And I think that's the lesson that Jesus was driving home to his disciples to help build their faith as they took the gospel to the world.